When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special One Thief Minute. Yes, that's right. It was a mini series that was honoring the life of Jimmy Kahn, resplendently stuffed with great people who've been part of the One Heat Minute Productions family for a long time. And then a monstrous guest, thanks to Rob Belushi, his dad, Jim Belushi, coming on to remember the making of the film and working with Jimmy and honoring him. Such a pleasure to do that couple of episode show, but just as all selfish podcasters should, I reserve the right to start the car in the garage of any shows that have previously been retired and parked and they feel like they're out to pasture. And I feel like the person that I'm talking to today kind of compelled me to do so. A couple of things happened. As always, I am such a huge fan of Bright Wall Dark Room. They're huge friends of the show. And two things happened. My guest, Sarah Welch Larson, wrote about Michael Mann's Thief, and the great Brianna Ashby drew Jimmy. And so two
incredible
things.
Incredible illustration.
You have my curiosity. Now you have my attention. Sarah wrote such an amazing piece. If you haven't read Sarah on Brightwall before, you absolutely should. Author of Becoming Alien, The Beginning and End of Evil in Science Fiction's Most Idiosyncratic Franchise, and the co-host of Seeing and Believing podcast, and now the upcoming author of the Seeing and Believing newsletter. Sarah Welch Larson, thank you so much for joining me on this One Thief Minute.
Thank you so much for having me, Blake. That illustration by Brianna is absolutely incredible. I actually got lucky enough to be able to buy it off her. So it's sitting in my house waiting for a frame, and I'm really excited to have that up on the wall. But that was just such a lovely gift from her.
It's gorgeous. And I actually commissioned one for this very show for her. I got her to just do like a little sketch of Jimmy relaxing, I guess, is probably the best way to describe it, after being, you know, soot covered. Sweating.
Lighting up that cigarette
with satisfaction. Yeah, an absolutely stunning image. Yes, I'm gonna see if I can buy a print off of Brianna. I think she already knew that I was gonna ask. So I was just like, oh my god. She's like, it's yours if you want it. I'm like, okay, fantastic. I can't get
it's
the
really
original,
cool
but you have it, and that's all that matters. But let's take a sidestep. So recently Brightwall, who I love, you guys were doing a high space issue. And it feels like a couple of strange, weird things happened. Like there was a couple of moments where some people were like talking about Michael Mann in context of the writer's strike as like a scab who was crossing the line and working with the studios and not acknowledging the fact that he was in post-production on Ferrari editing this film he's been trying to make for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it weirdly caused a lot of like a mini fissure online, because people had been using or thinking of Thief as one of the best, I don't know, capitalism skewerings of all time, and James Caan's character as that kind of guy, you know, I'm wearing it, you know, your money is in my pocket, the yield of my labor, all those wonderful lines had been kind of like typifying the strike. So was it just a confluence of that being in the air, or were you a fan? Because I'm not sure. I want you to tell me everything about your kind of fandom of this particular film and this text right now.
Oh, man. Well, I've lived in Chicago longer than I've lived anywhere else. So Chicago is home at this point, specifically yes. The South Side. And I don't think I think Thief might have actually been my first Michael Mann movie. So I watched it at a really weird point in time. It was the beginning of the pandemic, and we were living literally like right next to the metro tracks at the time. And the trains would go by, and the old sodium lights that show up in Thief don't exist anymore in the city of Chicago. They've been replaced by more modern lighting. But the metro trains have that same cast of green. So for the first few weeks of the pandemic, when nobody was out and nobody was doing anything, I would just see the trains go by and I would see all of those empty green lights. And that was right around the same time that I watched Thief. So it just kind of stuck in my head for a little while. And I love Michael Mann movies. I love the way that he's so focused on process and on the interiority of his men who are not willing to talk about their feelings at all whatsoever. And I love that he also doesn't marginalize the women in his movies the same way that the men in those movies do. So he's got a lot going for him. And Thief just kind of stuck in my craw, partly because the score is so good, the cinematography is so good. And then, of course, there's that performance by James Caan that's just, it's something that is so aggressive and unrelenting that you kind of have to respect it. And for me, I think he was just speaking my language at just the right time, because I was also feeling very hostile and closed off from everything else around me. And I needed that story. And I don't know. Yeah, it's just one of those movies that I'm just always thinking about. And so when I found out that Bright Waldorf Groom was going to be doing a heists issue, I immediately called dibs on Thief, because I knew that I wanted to write about that movie. And I've wanted to write about it for a really long time and just needed the excuse to do so.
It's funny. There's a, you know, that phrase that's in our parlance right now, like stay angry, you know, mm-hmm. like stay angry. Jimmy Caan in Thief is the archetype. He's the hero. He's the urtext of stay angry. It's like, it's like, I'm going to be unrelentingly myself and you have to cop it. And I think that there's a certain point that's so aspirational in a lot of our lives. He is obviously the extreme, but to be so confident with who you are and so uncompromising and so clear with what the kind of life and vision that you want, that there's a strange comfort despite his hostility that Thief always drags you back in, because it's like, this guy knows what he wants and he will go and get it. And if you're an impediment in his way, you better move, because otherwise he'll move you. And I love being comforted by that. And it's so weird to be so comforted by someone so hostile, but that is a beautiful contradiction of some of these movies. I'm like, yeah, I feel comfortable knowing a guy like him exists, because then you can sort of close your eyes and fantasize in your own life. If you're in a day job with, you know, bureaucratic sort of stuff, you're just like, man, wouldn't it be great to be a maverick like him and just talk to everyone like he talks to everyone, and wouldn't it be fantastic? But it's such is the romanticism and fantasy of this movie. You can't quite get it.
It's kind of wild too that Sonny Corleone went on to become even sharper and angrier, I think.
yeah.
And I guess he had a few more years to practice doing it or something, but he's just got that lovely physicality. Like when he's walking across the street, you know, you'd better not mess with this guy. And that's just him walking across the street even before anybody's pissed him off. He's just, you know, James Caan, he's triangular shaped and stay out of his way. And I love that physicality about him too.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And there's a couple of lines in your terrific piece of Brightwall, which I'll share along the way that I want to talk about. And one of them, which I think you got to so beautifully, talking about the cinematography, where you were talking about every interaction with Michael Mann, obviously his composition and Donald E. Thoren's camera work, saying that every conversation, every interaction becomes a heist. And I think that was probably the line of your piece for me, because I was like, oh, that's what it is. It's like the macro example of this is that everything in this guy's life is a heist, and everything's an opportunity, and everything is prepared and everything has a game plan and everything has an A, B, C options of how he's going to get out. And that layering in every interaction, it's like, oh, I get it. Like there is that now there's something additional unlocked, is that that's why he is hostile to Jesse. And that's why he's there in the room. It's because like, I'm giving you outs, or you're coming on the next heist with me. You know, I'm giving you outs at every opportunity. This is a bad idea. Get out. This is a bad idea. Get out. And if you're still on for all of these interactions, you're in the heist with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that also means that he's sort of, Michael Mann specifically, is almost implicating the audience and being along for the ride as well, too, because
100%.
He's brought us in along on this heist, and it's something that's exciting. And like you mentioned earlier, wouldn't we all like to be radicals out there robbing, the spoils of capitalism, because what else is there, you know? Yeah. And I don't know. I think it maybe speaks a little bit to the fact that this is Mann's first theatrical feature, unless I'm mistaken, right? And It's got that level of focus and drive that I think really only comes with someone who is either a seasoned master or somebody who has their first feature and thinks that this is all that they're going to be able to say. And so they better get it all out all at once. And I like that Mann is so driven and focused on, it's not delivering a message, because this isn't a message movie. It's much more of a character study, but he's so honed in on what makes James Caan's character tick that everything else is going to either be secondary or it's going to prop up that character trait about him. So everything's going to have to be a heist, because it had to be a heist in order for him to be able to get out of prison in the first place anyway. He kind of has to almost dehumanize himself to get by in the yards at Joliet Correctional. And then he carries that attitude like armor with him outside of prison, because he doesn't know how to survive in any other way. And I think that's one of the things that is most insidious about a system like capitalism, that kind of forces you into a box of either being able to be productive or being shut away from the rest of the world because you can't be productive, is it kind of dehumanizes people in a way that almost turns them into tools either for more production or for subverting the means of production. And I think Frank is one of those characters where he sees an out, and his out isn't quite getting there because he's not fully dismantling capitalism. He's just trying to, I think I use the term like loot capitalism, or like, yes, loot capitalism spoils. He wants what everybody else has, or he wants what he perceives everybody else as having. And because the only way he knows how to get it is through illegal means, he's going to do that just better than everybody else, because that's the only way he can get ahead. And that's just such a fascinating motivation for a character. It's not just, I want to be rich. It's, I want to get ahead of everybody else because I think I've been cheated before. And it's a beautifully focused motivation. It's also more than a little bit scary. And I think the reason why I like watching Jimmy Caan in this movie so much is because his character scares me. He's genuinely terrifying because he's, yes, got that sense of drive and that physicality. And you don't really ever know what he's going to do, but he's on the edge and he'll do whatever he needs to.
It's so funny. It's because this theme of Michael Mann's movies, I want to touch really on two big things that you said there. And the first one is, there's something beneath that laser focus and aggression and awareness of the, I guess, the inherent sort of lie of capitalism that only people who've been institutionalized can get. And it's a story that is more common than you realize, where, you know, a lot of people who are uneducated, lower class citizens and folks who don't have the economic means, they resort to crime because of lack of education, and they resort to crime because they want to try and get themselves out of their situation, and then they go to jail. And what happens is that, strangely enough, when they go to jail, like, there is an education happens, is because you don't have any other time to do anything. So you're trying to figure out, how did I get here and how did I become, you know, just a part of this machine? And so many of these guys have complete philosophical awakenings when they go away. And it's a trait that has been happening since, you know, his first TV movie, Jericho Mile, you know, discovering and being fascinated with prisoners. Eddie Bunker then inspires, you know, parts of Thief, obviously then parts of Heat, and these prisoners and the institutionalization that happens, and then the awakening and education philosophically that happens. And rather than him sort of coming out enlightened, his enlightenment is more rage, because it's like, oh, this is exactly what you're saying. It's like, it's a cheat. Why would I bother trying to be legitimate when the whole thing's a rigged game? So I just got to play the rigged game better than anyone else, which is sort of touches on that beautiful unpredictability that he has. But I think also, Sarah, you said something so poignant and spot on, is there is something so special about the theatrical movie, the first theatrical movie, especially in past generations, because now we've kind of got streaming has kind of muddied it somewhat slightly. So there's a little bit harder. Sometimes you see someone's first streaming movie, and if you don't get to see it theatrically, it's sort of tougher to sort of get a sense of who they are. But first movies from emerging filmmakers whose voices are so clear, and I like think of three off the top of my head all the time, like, or even four, it's like Spielberg with Jewel. And you're like, oh my God, who is this? Who is this person? You know, the Coen brothers with Blood Simple, Danny Boyle, Shallow Grave, and someone like Michael Mann with Thief. It's like, oh, the voices are so clear and so crisp. Immediately you're like, oh, okay, this is someone that I have to pay attention to. And there are many others, but those are the ones that pop into my mind of like, oh, there is a very clear cinematic voice here. And there's something so urgent about those, that first film by that first really terrific filmmaker. And when they literally throw the kitchen sink at it, because they think they may never get a chance to do it again. There's something, love the desperation of the art that you see.
Jordan Peele with Get Out.
Oh,
for
my
sure.
God. Yeah. Yeah. Just.
And I maintain that his movies keep getting better and better. Actually, yeah, Get Out is my least favorite of his, and I still like it very much.
Yeah.
And then also, I guess this one was one that I did see streaming first, but Emma Seligman's Shiva Baby has just a very specific voice to
it.
It's been so much fun to watch that sharpen a little bit more with Bottoms, which just came out. So, yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the best parts about it is that that voice, when the filmmaker is really, truly good, only gets sharper and sharper. So Thief is an incredible movie. I think about it all the time. Heat's even better. And that doesn't mean that one is like lesser than the other by any stretch. They're still very different, but it's kind of nice to be able to see that raw talent in a slightly more raw form. Sometimes I forget about that with the polish from later filmmakers' works.
I've been waiting for an opportunity to pitch a theory that has just sort of crystallized in my head. And I think that this is the perfect conversation to have it. It's that.
Sweet.
I feel like whenever I hear about someone like Barry Jenkins, Ava DuVernay, or I thought about it with Taika Waititi, but he's like drunk his own Kool-Aid so much forever. Like, I mean, his film Boy and The Hunt for the Wilder People, like two of those films, two of the best films out of the Southern Hemisphere, in my opinion, this century, and you should see them and they're amazing. Other stuff I don't want to talk about, but just saying those three particular filmmaking examples that I'll say is, I feel like that there is like such a toxic, or maybe it's like poisonous urge for some of these huge movie studios, that what they do is there is an emerging cinematic voice. They make a independent, gorgeous, stunning, original piece of work. It busts through. And if it's Moonlight, it is made for $4 million over 2 weeks and wins an Academy Award, makes like $100 million. Everyone in the movie goes on to have wonderful careers. Ava, Selma, amazing, etc. Right? I then feel like they are the worst, like NFL, NRL coaches, whatever you want to call it. In Australia, it's like rugby league and states. I'll say NFL for the purposes of the people listening. It feels like the evil NFL coach and system that pays a squillion bucks to get a player and then puts them on injury reserve.
Mm.
Like, you're in our system. You're now part of the NFL. Congratulations. You're on injury reserve. You don't get to throw any passes. They bring them into these systems that like takes, you know, fortunately it hasn't happened with Jordan Peele as an example, but like Barry Jenkins is going off apparently making a Lion King movie, and bless him, I'm glad that he's making money. Fantastic. But like Ava DuVernay got swamped into the Warner Brothers thing of it all for a chunk of time. Barry gets chucked into the Disney machine to go do that. Other filmmakers, it feels like they get swallowed up and then they're in the machine and then they don't make anything for like 5 years because the dumb animated crap that we are, the dreck that we get served is like there. So it feels like they're almost serving time. They're serving time. And I feel like that's the kind of that's the kind of Robert Prosky of it all here. It's like, you're in my pocket, right? Like, why am I being a partner? Oh, I can look after you and this and that. And I feel like that's what happens to all of these great filmmakers. They are there, and the ones that stay out are willing to kind of burn it down, right? Like, they're just willing to kind of stay out. And it's so hard to be a part of this system and to be a part of this world and have a balance before it goes completely off the rails. And I feel like genuinely that, like, whenever I hear that a new great filmmaker that I'm really excited about is going to be making some kind of Disney BS, the first thing I think about is, yes, get that money. And the second thing I think about is, this is actually a poison chalice. They're just taking you out of the rotation so you can't go make a movie for $4 million that has massive box office and streaming appeal, and they take you out of the rotation. Well, you're out now. You can't go and make anything that's in competition. You're in the system. You make it for us.
That really bums me out, especially because it feels, I mean, there's no other way to say it, you know, it just bums me out. And part of me wonders if the voice ends up getting pulled into some sort of, I don't know, like, it feels as though the filmmaker's voices tend to get diluted by studio notes to a point where there is not very much distinction. And sometimes you can still see those flashes coming through. I don't know, Greta Gerwig's Barbie really feels like a Greta Gerwig movie, a little much more so than it does feel like a commercial, I worry a little bit.
There's some things that are accidents, right? And some, yeah. Honestly, making a movie about a doll, and I'm saying that with no judgment, you know, G.I. Joe, like, there's like the G.I. Joes, it's happened before, any kind of toy product, Transformers, obviously the Michael Bay ones, I kind of, you know, despite being strange, like, this amazing treatise on the American military, at least the first three. And it's kind of, I think sometimes they kind of go, I don't know if this is going to work, so have a crack, right? And they kind of like let it go. And I think those are more like accidents. Like, the first Barbie's like, I'm going to make this uncompromising thing. We're going to do it here. You're going to give us the money. And they kind of were probably sold on the fact that they could sell it with merchandise. They didn't have to make any. And then it comes out and you're like, oh my God, look at this thing. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Yeah. It feels like it's got personality. It, you know, has little vignettes that feel like a Busby Berkeley musical and 2001 A Space Odyssey and, you know, all these gorgeous, you know, old Hollywood sort of stylings. But yeah, I almost feel like some of those get to be an accident because they're like,
level, yeah. I feel like I've heard that Gerwig did have to fight for a vision, but I don't know that anybody else is going to get that level of freedom with anything from Mattel ever again, which, no. Again, like, it really bums me out. And what I really hope is that a lot of these directors who do get kind of stuck in studio hell do get the chance to make one for themselves and then one for the studio and so on and so forth. I feel like that was something that used to happen a little bit more, but with a little bit more freedom, if that makes sense. So the blockbuster followed by the personal project going back and forth. But it feels as though nowadays, if you're going to get to do the blockbuster project, it's going to be something that costs $50 million, or not 50 million. That's a ridiculously low number for a lot
That's a modest movie, 50 mil.
Yeah. Geez. Like, I don't know what, $500 million, we'll just say, like, a ridiculous amount of money. And then if they're very, very lucky, they'll get to make it back and maybe get to finance something else that they're more interested in. And I don't know, like, I would love to see more people coming out of that system with the same kind of drive that we get in Thief, but so far I don't think I've seen too many of those. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head.
No, it's really hard. I mean, you know, great filmmaker Rian Johnson. I mean, makes three movies as the great Christopher McQuarrie, great director, says Rian Johnson is a genius. He made Star Wars in four moves, right? Like, and then made Star Wars, and then got out, and the making Knives Out, which then became its own kind of mini behemoth, and Glass Onion, and that series is like locked him up there. But he's making his original content, Agatha Christie style movies, Benoit Blanc, like, now as his franchise of three movies, making them together. And he's kind of the only guy that, in my mind, has like done it, has like gone out and then come back. Like, it's, you know, it's so rare to see someone go in, have an amazing entry into a series and then bounce out and then be like, it's all good. We're fine here. Like, thank you very much. You know, that it's so hard to manage.
And remained a good person throughout, I think, from yes. what I can tell. He seems like a stand-up guy.
Yeah, really stand-up guy, like a sweetheart. And yeah, it hasn't, I mean, and if you can walk out of being a Star Wars director and still have any faith in humanity, I think like you're
he's a better person than the rest of us.
You're doing okay, man. You're doing okay.
100%.
But yeah, so it's really, I this movie, yeah, I think the scrappiness, if you like, or the rougher edges, even though that's pretty unfair because like it feels like it's such an accomplished as far as everything technically, but the slight rougher edges on this, I don't know, they seem to have a bit of texture. They're like a sandpaper. They seem to grab you. There's something that like catches you every time that this movie's on, and every time that someone talks about it, there's just something more urgent about it. And I think that, you know, James Caan was always someone who was respected. He was a gigantic movie star in his day, and but everyone sort of always thought of him more as a personality, and he was always more out there and verbose about the stories and those things, and was stuck in his own iconic franchise of The Godfather that always sort of, you know, he was in one of the greatest movies of all time, so people talk about it all the time constantly. But I love that this is, and since his passing, it feels like Thief, just for his work as a performer, has been elevated to a new level of like, actually, if you really want to see this guy be one of the best actors in the world and dwarf everyone, watch Thief, because that's kind of the movie. And it was so nice to hear the stories of him, you know, always being super fond of his work in Thief as maybe the best film he ever made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I miss him a lot. I miss his presence. I miss seeing him on screen. I guess you can always go back and see some of those old performances, but I don't know. I do miss seeing him being gregarious over on the website that will now remain nameless.
End of time.
Something like that. Yeah. But I feel like even though he was so, I don't know, he was such an interesting presence, there's kind of that level of like rough around the edgesness that I think endeared me to him as a person as well as a performer. And what also endeared me to Thief 2, like this movie wouldn't be the same movie if it had a lot of gloss to it. Like that's not who the characters are. That's not what the story is. It makes sense that everybody's rough and tumble and kind of suspicious of everybody else who has a little bit of that polish to them. So I don't know. It feels like a perfect confluence of the performers and then the skill level of Michael Mann at that point in time, and then everybody else in the cast and crew who all very clearly know what they're doing, and they're also working on effectively like almost nothing at all for a short amount of time in order to be able to make this incredible movie. Like, I don't know, it feels like they caught lightning in a bottle here, and that even that phrase feels a little bit too slick for what's going on, I think. Like, it's still got those rough edges, and lightning doesn't really have that.
No, and it's also like there's something, because Michael Mann had come out of, you know, writing television and been making little bits and pieces, made his first television movie, it just feels like he wasn't able to assemble necessarily like a world-beating cast top to bottom. But once you get Jimmy, you then get all these other people that make this beautiful cast real and breathe, and hiring real life crooks to be cops and hiring real life cops to play crooks, and then getting Prosky, who's like 50 in his first theatrical role, to come in. And it's just like it feels so like if you knew about this local guy who was a theater actor in my local, you know, community, he could out-act, you know, Laurence Olivier, and you're like, whatever. And this is the movie where it kind of does it. It's like, who the hell is this guy? He's better than anyone we've ever seen before. It kind of does that. It gets all these little component parts of all these unexpected people, and when it puts them together, there's a harmony that is almost like it can never be replicated, because then immediately as soon as they're identifiable and they've got this, you know, this juice that people want to also, you know, sample, it's like, it's never going to be the same again, because it was just that one time, that one piece of alchemy, that's it.
Yeah. I think that also speaks to the very Chicago nature of the movie too.
Yes. It's
kind of that sort of big city, but also a very working class city in a lot of ways, very much a union town, speaking of the labor pieces of this movie as well. And then also, I love Chicago. I feel like the city does have a little bit of a complex as being the second city in comparison to New York City, and then also kind of caught in between New York and LA in some interesting ways. And we're not always going to complain about it, but there is still that tension there. And I think that more like you turn around the corner, you're not going to see a celebrity. You turn around the corner, you're going to see your neighbor, and they're going to have a really interesting face and really interesting stories to tell. And I think that that works so well with this movie too, because everybody on film in this movie has such an interesting face. And a lot of that is because they are those ordinary people who may also have been able to go on and have good careers on screen, but because they're unknowns there, they feel so fresh. Even if you recognize their face from a later project, it's still, this is the young version of this person, you know?
Yeah, it's the young version of the old Dennis Farina, because he came in like at that exact age. John Santucci, who plays Arizzi, is like a real life, you know, crook. There's faces, there's actors, you won't necessarily know them, but it's like Walter Scott, Gavin McFadden, Tom Signorelli, all these faces. Obviously the beautiful Tuesday World, you know, is the offsider here. And then again, which you talk about in your piece, the beautiful performance of Willie Nelson as Oakler, who leans forward and says, you know, get me out of here. You know,
I love that line delivery.
It's perfection. He looks at Frank in such an interesting, loving, caring way. And when he sneaks up on him with that line, his eyes are wide and they show fear, and he says, you know, get me out of here. And doesn't strike me as a guy that ever would look like he was fearful. Always looks so casual and relaxed, and like the world will just roll around him. But it's so special. He was so special in this movie as well.
It's such a beautiful moment of vulnerability too. And for all of its hard edges, I think this is also a movie that gets vulnerability right, because it's the kind of thing that you only do when you're willing to let your guard down around people that you trust. So you get the vulnerability in the diner scene, but you also get that vulnerability right there in that moment of get me out of here. I don't want to die in here.
Yeah.
And I think with those few words, he's effectively telling Frank, like, I love you. I trust you. I need you to be the person that I was for you when we were both inside. And the fact that he's able to get all of that across with just that one simple line reading really speaks to the efficiency of the script, I think, but also just the power of Willie Nelson as a performer. He's just so, so good in this.
He's super special. This movie is like hallowed turf, you know. It's really hard. Like First Nations people in Australia, some Indigenous people, like, they believe that they don't mention the names of people or show photographs of people who passed in their culture because it brings back their spirit. And so you have to be sort of delicate. You know, in Australia, sometimes when we're doing documentaries and things like that, we'll often put, you know, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who have those beliefs, like faces and the names of people who have passed away are going to be said again. And, you know, I think that that's kind of a beautiful and haunting sentiment of the past as it moves past, that like you're bringing these people back to life, and sometimes their spirit are going to have, it's not always going to be about positive. Sometimes it's going to bring back heartache and it's going to bring back trauma. And I've watched Thief, and fortunately for me, it's still a celebration, but I almost think that like whenever I hear it now, there's all of these actors and great performances and great, you know, people who've had such an influence or impact over me in my cinematic viewing life that had an impact on our culture, that you watch it and you're like, oh, it's like a sorrowful thing that all these people, so many of them, are no longer with us. And this is that one time that they're all together and all in harmony beautifully in this great and powerful and affecting piece. All these people are so amazing.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And sad and affecting. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have anything intelligent to say about it other than well said. Yeah.
No, well, look, thank you so much for doing this little bonus. Thank you for your beautiful piece. And I want to read the last line of your piece, which is, he pulls off the perfect job. He walks out without any money and leaves no trace of himself behind. He abandons the dream. It was all only paper anyway. Thank you so much for your beautiful piece. Thank you so much for talking to me and tussling with Thief again. And just thank you so much. So do you want to plug? Is there anywhere else that you want to plug now for people to find you, for people to read anything? Please, Sarah, share, because I'm so grateful for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Blake. This was a wonderful conversation. People can find me all over the internet at Dodgy Boffin.
It's funny, you know, all over the internet.
I am all over the internet at Dodgy Boffin. Probably the easiest way to get in touch with me is just through my newsletter. It's dodgyboffin.ghost.io. I just send out weekly issues with links to the stuff that I've written or that I've podcasted about. So if you want to keep up with me, that's the best way to do it. I'm also a staff writer for the aforementioned Brightwall Darkroom. Love everybody there. And I also write an additional newsletter called Seeing and Believing with Kevin McLenathan, who's a fellow Chicago critic out here, where we review newer releases and then whatever else we feel like writing about.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.